Welcome to Body and Culture Convos. I'm your host, Tina Foster, and today we're talking about somatic experiencing and authentic movement with our guest, Weena Pauly Tarr. Weena, to introduce her a little bit, she's been working and playing in the worlds of dance, movement training, and somatic therapy in New York City for the last 23 years. Weena has been trained as a teacher in various movement modalities, including yoga, mindfulness meditation, Pilates, functional strength, and somatic experiencing, and is currently working as a yoga therapist and a somatic experiencing practitioner. She founded her somatic therapy practice called Reconnect in 2008. And in Reconnect, she offers somatic therapy sessions for individuals and facilitates somatic movement groups. As a dancer, Weena has been a company member of STREB, Brian Brooks Moving Company, David Newman Advanced Beginner Group, and Young Jean Lee's Theater Company, and most recently, Katie Workham. Weena is currently one of the co-founders of Duvet, which is an authentic movement collective where 8 movement artists explore performance and radical cultural development using authentic movement practice. And they offer improvisational performances, events, and classes. And in early 2020, during the pandemic, Weena created SEAM, S-E-A-M, or S-E plus A-M, which is somatic experiencing plus authentic movement. And that's what we're here to talk about today. Weena lives in New York City with her husband, 4 kids, and bunny. Welcome, Weena.
Hi. Thanks for having me, Tina.
I'm so excited that you're here. You're just the person that I wanted to talk to about, namely, the power of movement to facilitate change, the individual experience of movement, but also the cultural experience of it and the power that movement has to bring cultural change, and the combination of somatic experience and authentic movement is so intriguing. When I first saw the description of somatic experience and authentic movement together, something just clicked in my mind. Mm-hmm. Like, wow, this is 2 things that come together to make something greater than the sum of the parts. And so I really am looking forward to unpacking all that with you. But before we do that, I'm wondering if you would be willing to just give us a short introduction to each modality, somatic experiencing, then authentic movement, and how they might come together or be combined to bring what you call a reverence for impulse.
Mm-hmm. Thanks for that. Let me tell you a little about SE. We call it SE, somatic experiencing. I'll give kind of like a brief little intro to each and then we'll go from there. SE is a body-centered modality that's based in healing trauma and other stress disorders. Dr. Peter Levine, who came from the medical biophysics world, got super curious about how wild mammals in particular, and animals who underwent tremendous stress, didn't reveal any stress disorders from that threat. They returned to thriving and surviving. And so he started to study them. Why aren't they losing function the way humans are when they undergo this sort of stress? And that became the basis of his research. And he did clinical work for decades and decades around that, and developed this modality called SE. SE has 2 main functions in terms of what its intention is. One is to facilitate the completion of self-protective motor responses, and the other is to release thwarted survival energy. And through both of those, there's a reintegration of the what they call sort of trauma retention or held energy in the body. And people exhibit really incredible, not just repatterning, but the ability to thrive and expand beyond their what they felt was very limiting in their lives. So that's sort of ESSI. Authentic movement is just a movement practice. It was developed by Mary Starks Whitehouse in the 50s. And it is a practice where you have a mover and a witness. And you are, the mover closes their eyes and moves from impulse. And the witness is there to make sure they're safe, physically safe, and to witness the mover. Very simple. The idea of it is about creating a movement pathway that offers a bridge between the conscious and the unconscious. It's a exploration of relationship between mover and witness, being seen and seeing. And the idea is that each person in each role is paying attention to what happens inside of them or what the experience is like. And then they switch roles. They do the same practice. And then after, they sit and talk about what that was like. In more sort of traditional AM, there are more, I won't say rules, but they're a little more specific about how you share. And in the work I do in SEAM, that's a little different based on more of the sort of triad and dyad work in SE that I've used. So it's a, when I brought them together, part of the idea for me was what I started witnessing in authentic movement in my own, in the collective I'm with, was some of the effects of SE were happening in this group without it being the intention. It was almost a byproduct. And I was in the process of studying SE. I was at the Somatic Experiencing Institute, and a lot of the things they were using as markers of health and wellness and thriving and connection and liberation, I was sort of watching unfold through this authentic movement practice. And I got really curious about what was going on there. And so I started to just bring in some of these ideas of SE into authentic movement more as a frame. Like, how is survival response showing up here? What happens when we're not under threat with impulse? What is the physiological state of imagination and creation? And there were different ways and different themes of SE that I would bring in and use to explore the authentic movement practice. So that's how that started. And it's continuing to unfold. I don't exactly know what this is growing in this petri dish. I trust it. That's the thing I keep saying. And there are many ways that I feel like SE is the choreography and authentic movement is the dance. Or SE is the tangible explanation of something that's happening in authentic movement in an experiential way. So there's these ways that they can hold a kind of polarity, but they can also move towards each other and describe something when they're used together, or when we use the language or the experience of both of them together, that feels new. It's like the Venn diagram, that shade is different. It's a different new color. And I want to stay there. I want to stay exploring. And I'm just really, I'm curious about it.
The emergent aspect of this in the petri dish, as you say, is what makes it so amazing. And one of the reasons I want to talk about it with you. I like that it's something that is open-ended and is being treated as a process rather than a means to achieve a certain result. Because in our society, we can get really sabotaged by the result. We're all after the result, of course. We all want to feel better. We all want to be strong and healthy. We all want to grow and innovate. And those are results. But they're also processes. Mm. And I think that when we look at these things, when we approach these things as processes, we're already feeling more safe. Because it's so safe, it's part of what, or an example of what exactly what our culture needs at this time. Okay, so let's talk about how we get to the reverence of impulse. So we know an authentic movement, as you said, the mover closes their eyes and begins to move according to impulse. How does the SE, the somatic experiencing, support the reverence for impulse?
That's a good question. It's a good one. Well, inherent in both modalities is a trust of our body. There's an inherent trust in our body's ability to function, and not only function, but to seek more aliveness, to try to create thriving. That is inherent in both modalities, that's just sort of at our core. And there are these strategies that we've learned through developmental, ancestral, cultural strategies. We've learned to mitigate our own wounding and disconnection, separation, that are in the way of our connection, in the way of our integration. And so both of those modalities, although I don't think that they either one explicitly states that, that's definitely deep in there. And that's the reverence of impulse. Like if I am on this call long enough, at some point I need to pee. There is an impulse to pee. Our body is constantly knowing or creating choices and directions for how to stay alive. That's at the core. When we go through, you know, traumatic events, developmental trauma, all these different, the big T traumas, but I would also say cultural trauma, ancestral trauma, there are, I believe that it creates motor patterns and movement pathways that inhibit our impulse's desire to create new. Does that make sense?
Yes,
they're blanketed.
It does.
They're blanketed. That impulse is always there. And I think that's sort of what my passion for SEEM is really, is to uncover that. And I know, you know, I want to say the caveat is, I know in circles and worlds of addiction, there's a lot of different conversation around impulse, right? That can be your downfall. If I listen to my body, that will lead me to destruction, disconnection, bad things. And I don't want to discount that experience. And I think that's actually very relevant. It's another field of this that I really want to move deeply into. And actually, one of my colleagues who works with addiction specifically, he and I have discussed this, because it feels like a point of contention around just how do we follow impulse if there's no trust there, if we don't trust that. And I think that what they're feeling actually is the impulse of strategy, not the impulse of aliveness. But that sounds like I'm saying, well, if you just stick with it, if you just stay there long enough, you'll eventually feel the impulse for aliveness. I don't want it to sound like there are layers or stages or some sort of like trajectory line here of better than, like listening better. I just want to say and be inclusive of everyone has a very specific relationship to their own impulse. My intention is to learn how to develop a relationship to it. So it's not that we're always following impulse. It's that we're having a conversation and a relationship to it.
Our relationship to impulse. Aha. Okay. That's the key to the reverence for impulse. Before we can have reverence to impulse, we have to just basically be able to trust our impulse. Okay.
Or at least value it, right? At least that it has some value. Even if it's saying, go eat 12 Krispy Kreme donuts, there's some value in listening to that for a moment. It doesn't, like in SE, what you learn is to stay with that feeling long enough to get to know it, not to follow it into action directly. SE brings in slowing down. It adds in time and space so that you get to linger or you get to deepen a relationship to an impulse, a bodily impulse. And in SE sessions, there'll be a time where you'll notice someone's hand starts to do something automatically. And we will just focus on what is the movement that's wanting to happen there. Not to follow it to its end, but to get in touch with what is it trying to, what is the body wanting to do?
So, yeah. What is the body using that hand to do? Okay, the hand, the answer might be, well, the hand is picking up the glass of alcohol. But then, okay, yeah, that's what it's doing. But underneath that, what is it doing? So we're getting to know our relationship to impulse in a deeper way. So it's not the superficial aspect of the impulse that we might call reaching for the glass. It's the deeper yearning, wanting, desire, the story behind those desires that is in some ways really, really matters, right?
Mm. Yes. And instead of it being a sort of cognitive conversation about why, it's can I experience want without getting? Can I experience longing without it being sated? When we talk about building up our capacity or opening the window of tolerance, as they say in SE, it's really about building our capacity to be with the discomfort that's showing up. And I will say there are physiological states where you are hijacked, where that's not an option, right? Like I can't not do that. That's not a choice. There is a place where you are not, you don't have access to choice. And that's very real. So those are the kind of states that SE works really well with, I would say. And in authentic movement, what's interesting is I've had impulses that are huge, like wanting to put my knee through a door or something incredibly strong. It's not that I don't think that impulse has value, but I want to feel the origin of it long enough to get to know it. Because when I express it and do it, it's gone. It's no longer within the container of my experience. So if I can stay and slow down long enough to feel what that feels like before expressing my knee through the door, it's not that that's surely a movement pattern to follow. Why not? Sometimes it's because if I stay long enough with getting to know that, it will shift. A deeper something shifts and something else comes into the field and some other way of being with it presents itself.
Yeah. So when we allow ourselves to slow down and touch our discomfort. It's not that we're a masochist. It's that we're savoring the flavor, to use one of my own expressions, savoring the flavor of the discomfort. And you might not be savoring it in the way of, oh, this is such a yummy flavor of discomfort, but you're savoring it in the sense that you are not pushing it away. You're not distracting yourself. You're not spitting it out. You're allowing yourself to taste it, because it's obviously a part of your experience if it's there at this time. Yeah. And then authentic movement allows the ability to express it. And I love that you said once the movement is expressed or once the impulse is expressed, it's gone. Okay. So I want to go a little bit deeper because we tend to think about these things as individual in terms of individual experience. Individual trauma, individual movement, authentic movement brings in the witness. So we start to move from an individual practicing alone, but with witnessing an authentic movement, the witness brings in the mutual aspect. You talk about the possibilities in this work for new culture.
Mm-hmm.
And you specifically say in one of your writings about this work, you say, There were liberatory characteristics of possibility, of imagination and newness that emerged from quote unquote psychologically safe AM experiences, both for the mover and the witness. This felt like a place where new culture could grow. This felt like the quote unquote cracks in the sidewalks of modernity that Bayo Akomolafe uses. I know you're not a spokesperson for Mr. Akomolafe, but can you speak a little bit to what you think he means by that expression?
Mm. Yes. He's like a new voice this year of inspiration for me, and I'm hoping to continue to study his work. But part of what he inspires in me, when he speaks, I light up because he brings such eloquence and articulation to that experience of when we are in physiological, and that's the SE version, right? The physiological safe state, when we're in a place of creation or imagination, inherently our needs are met, right? We feel mutual regard. There are a couple of key elements that can elicit that physiological safe place. When that's in place, the trappings of culture, of identity, begin to become porous. They crack. And there are new versions or new authentic expressions of aliveness, of humanity that start to spill forth. And that is just, to me, as opposed to it being the intention, like I'm going to do this AM practice so that I can do that. It turns out that it's just in the returning over and over again to this place where there is mutual regard, where there are needs and respect, needs are met, respect is there, conflict can happen, repair can happen. When we are in that kind of garden, what grows is so wildly diverse. It is so extremely bountiful and exciting. And that's sort of what I mean about it being culture change. There's so many strategies and so many ways to be right now that if I do this, then that will happen. If I create this, if I recognize my own internal, racism, if I consistently acknowledge a Black body that I'm with this specific way, if I employ these strategies, then I will be okay. It's not working. Like if we're going to do a radical shift, if white body supremacy delusion is going to crumble, there has to be a recognition of not just our culpability, our own patterning, our own systems, our own ancestry of harm, all that, and enough aliveness for something new to emerge, because we just keep recycling and creating the flip. So instead of flipping the power dynamics, and now I'm a little bit off on a tangent, but if we are to create actual new culture that is not based in hierarchical structures of power, we have to approach building them differently. We can't just keep approaching building them the same way. And to me, that's movement patterns. My movement Yes. patterns have to be different. My body needs to move through the world differently. I need to walk into a room with a different pattern because Yes. the one I'm employing is not working.
Yes, yes. And you say, in that same quote I read, you say, I begin to see it. The potential for creating a new culture that is free from habituated responses and bodily directives. So it's not that we want to truly be free of habituated responses. Habituated responses are actually part of what keeps us alive.
Exactly.
And so that we're not reinventing the exactly. wheel with every single movement and moment yes. that we live. But you mean habituated responses that numb us, or to use your expression, dim our wonder.
Yes. They're all systems of falsifying safety, really. right? And so
yes,
that's not deep safety. That's sort of like false safety, and false safety doesn't provide a physiological state for creativity. It creates a state of numbness, of freezing, of dimming, of wonder. And that is an oppressive way of quote unquote safety, systems of safety. So it's a little bit, when we start talking about trauma and this idea, and this is a little edgy, but when we say trauma-informed yoga or trauma-informed thing, to me, it's a little dicey, and I'm working through this, but I do not want to create a system that I deem safe that other people can walk into. I don't trust my own creation of other people's safety. And that's where the authentic movement piece comes in for me. When we are deeply connected into impulse, our own impulse of aliveness, there's an authenticity, there's a clarity of self that comes out that is so free of that cultural pattern. There's new possibility in those spaces. And that's the place I want to continue to explore and live in. And it, your bio says this too, but it's orienting continually around the idea of curiosity over conviction. When I start to stand in a place of, I know how to make this trauma informed, that's a huge red flag for me.
And notice how that's coming back to result instead of process. I'm making this trauma informed. Okay. It has a trauma informed stamp on it now. That, you know, that kind of relationship to result, actually it kills process. It leads to a place where people can pretend to be going through a process and basically be living out a spiritual bypass, you know, in the name of a practice.
Right.
And that's something that our spiritual traditions are full of, especially in the modern world. This type of empty relationship to what is actually happening in the moment, which you can only know if you're in a place of process.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Follow the rules. I mean, and that's where authenticity is a radical idea. The thing that's interesting to me about authentic movement as a model is there's no teacher. In these groups I run, I also do the practice. I'm here to facilitate, and that's a role. And sometimes I don't get to. But it's not because I'm doing AM better or I know. I don't. It's really, there's a flattening of this process where everybody who walks into these groups is an expert on themselves and their impulse and has wisdom to share. And the idea of coming together around that fire together without one person leading, without this idea of a person who knows more, is radical in any kind of learning environment, at least in this country, because we're taught that to learn, you give up ownership or agency and you listen. And there's not that that's, I don't, there's nothing negative about that. It's just not the only way to create learning and growth. And the way that I'm interested in is when I am continually brought to my knees, to my own humility around what I think I know.
Yes. And that touches on something else that you have written that I really resonate with. The authentic movement practices where mutual regard, honesty, and mystery are revered and explored together seemed to begin unwinding cultural threat responses without having any intention to do so. Practicing authentic movement with mutual regard, honesty, and mystery, exploring them together seemed to begin unwinding cultural threat responses without the intention to do so. Without the intention to do so.
Mm-hmm.
That is important. I mean, it's touching again on the result, like what we were talking about before, being in the process as opposed to the result. But the intention in these things to bring change can often get in the way of said change.
Mm.
Right?
Yes. Yeah. And it's almost, I mean, there's the like follow your bliss or orient around joy and pleasure. I mean, there are deep reasons for that. There are things that are able to emerge and come forth as offshoots of growth that are unexpected when those are held in the center. I think you're right. There's something about like, I want to create a new culture. So what is culture? Then you define culture, and then let's define what culture is and then make new versions of all that. It's,
yes.
Again, it's just replacing systems with systems from the same impulse.
Yes.
What else is there? How else can we do this? Yeah.
So then what you're talking about a lot of the time is what you call the ability or opportunity to experience a new way of being with each other. You say the growth conditions I hope to offer sustain connection without intellectual escapism, competition for worth, or compartmentalized judgment. So a new way of being together without these things getting in the way. Building culture without saying, okay, we want to build a new culture, guys. So let's see. What are the steps? Step one, step two, step three. And we have our strategy. Now we just do the strategy over and over again. That's so heady, right? That's really different than getting together and going deep into the body together and bringing out what we find there for others to see, for others to reflect back to us. And then we all begin to talk about not just what it means, but what it means based on how it feels.
Mm.
There's a truth in that, right?
It makes me think of, if it's to do this top-down sort of template for culture building is a complete denial of our animal, I don't want to say animal, we are human animals, but our inherent impulse for thriving, for survival. It's in all living things. There's an example for me is there are these, in New York, there's often these lots between buildings that are fenced off that have not been developed. They're sort of weirdly shaped. And when you go into those spaces, yeah, there's garbage. You know what else there is? Some of the most biodiverse growth of plants and insects of anywhere else in the city. Biodiverse meaning, I don't know what the rule is. Is it like more than 5 species or something? I can't remember what deems it biodiverse, but there's some explanation for it being diverse. And it's that's going to happen. That explosion of growth is going to happen. It will. It happens all the time. It's all around us. And when we stop limiting it, when we stop turning on this artificial sense of safety in order to control or shape that growth, amazing possibilities can emerge. And so, I want to say, like, I'm all for structure. It sounds very anarchist. It's not. I think I thrive very much in structure. You can ask my children. It's like, we are on time. Like there's a need for me to feel structure, to feel the containment. But there's also an incredible passion towards that stuff that keeps pushing up against it. And what happens when you just let it, it's going to do its thing. And so when growth, that new growth of culture is happening in our collective, it's not because we set out to do it. It's because we created growth conditions and that sort of explosion of connection, mutual regard, possibility, imagination, newness happened all on its own, not because we were set out to do that. And it's an example of that diversity, that growth. Yeah.
And then another phrase that you use that I really like is, quote, trusting culture, meaning we have a trusting culture. We've allowed a trusting culture to emerge as opposed to an untrusting one. This trusting culture of mutual guard and care emerged quite naturally in the time I practice authentic movement. How we had shared food, how we came and went, how we were able to tend to our individual needs within the practice, what happened when we revealed our pain and joy and birthdays, and how we showed up to support each variation of personal process gave way to profound connection and authenticity. And this was not our intention. It was just what grew. Trusting culture. You know, we think when we plant seeds that we're the one growing the flower. And in fact, we are helping that flower to grow. But the flower is capable of growing from a seed without us even knowing it's there. It can be born and die and without any human being ever seen, because it's in one of those lots in New York that you're talking about. We tend to be very human-centric, and that's not a very trusting way to be. We're actually not trusting the universe. It's as if we don't believe the universe has the power to generate and create life, you know, using life force, create all sorts of things in infinite variations, totally without us. And because we don't trust the universe, we're not able to trust ourselves as one living component of said universe.
Yes. That the human-centric version of a lot of staying alive is such a interesting one when I try to think of what happened that we decided the only way to survive was to become human-centered, to the exclusion of all other living things, that our cultures would be oriented around human beings. When did that start? Like, what sort of threat response is that? And I think it's, you know, there is something pretty special happening with human animals. Our ability to create stories, our ability to have self-reflection. And I guess I get confused when I think about, so at what point did this sort of traumatic survival response get switched on and continue to repattern us to seek overpowering, to seek power holding? When did that happen? Like, what was the impetus for that whole development of culture? I don't know.
Yeah. And now we're faced, that's led to climate change, for example. And now we're faced with, you know, having to quickly figure out ways to get back to the trusting culture. Mm-hmm. Trusting culture wasn't something humans made. Trusting culture is, you know, an essential component of the universe. And we need to get it back in our human cultures, in the way that we truly, it doesn't mean we believe everything that each other says, or that we don't have conflict or disagreements when we're in trusting culture. In fact, when we're in truly trusting culture, we can disagree very strongly with each other because we trust that it's going to be okay, that it's not going to be seen as a loss of face to stand up and disagree and show emotion and talk about what you believe in. We're trusting each other. And what is really amazing and magical about that is it's happening all on its own. I say it's magical to me. When I say that, I realize, wow, I too have believed that, you know, in this non-trusting culture. I too, if this surprises me and I find it magical, then that means that's when I really see how I've been hoodwinked by the system.
That is interesting. It's interesting that you're bringing that perspective in that way, because I can hear it differently when you say that. And it,
how so?
I think it's shining a light on something that is true for me, and I would say gifted from my parents in the way that I have moved through. And this is certainly a product of privilege. It is certainly a product of having white skin, but I feel that I have generally moved through my life assuming people are good, assuming I'm not going to get jerked around, assuming, you know, all kinds of assumptions that have allowed me to fall a few times for sure. And I can hear, you know, even when I say that, I can hear how problematic it sort of sounds and the grief that it brings me to recognize that that's inherently a privilege.
Thank you for sharing that with us.
Yeah. And I also think that, that it doesn't mean that that's a wrong way to be. It means that everyone should be that way, that everyone should have be given the opportunity to walk through the world trustingly, that every human should be able to move through the world assuming good, assuming regard, and that that's not true is incredibly, you know, it just speaks to the layers upon layers of wounding and harm globally, but I'm speaking more specifically to the States. But I think I'm saying all that because it wasn't hard for me to step into a process of trust. And that's not been true for people in the collective. And I don't want to speak for anyone, but I know that for other people, for the Black bodies in our group, there have been moments where for them to close their eyes, and this has been something that's communicated out loud, to close your eyes and have a white person watching you move, it took a lot of practice and it took a lot of time to build that kind of trust, to build the opportunity for risk-taking or vulnerability. That was not inherent in the beginning. And so that's important for me to acknowledge because it's not just AM. It's the returning again and again and again to the actual humans who are in the room, to our own humanity over and over again, to be with the discomfort that shows up, to be with the lack of safety that's felt or the lack of trust. So when I say trusting culture was built, it was, but not easily, not in a day. It took a lot of time. It was 5 years, 4 years of coming together.
So there's a layer of where we're building culture as opposed to creating strategy, to use a notion from Resmaa Menakem.
Yeah.
It's one of my favorite parts of his work, the idea of building culture, just getting together, meeting, using another expression of his, doing the reps.
Yes.
You do the reps. You get the reps in and over again. And at times it probably seems like nothing is happening, but you slowly begin to realize that you're sloughing off conditions that you've taken on that aren't helping you. And you're returning to you're building trusting culture with one another, but you're also returning to the trusting culture that is the inherent part of being in the universe.
Yeah.
A baby comes into this world trusting.
Trusting, completely.
They have to trust.
In order to survive. Their survival is dependent on connection.
Yeah. And trust then becomes something that we're taught is a weakness often, is a naivete, is a lack of having your own ideas, trusting other people's ideas. And just as we were talking about deep safety versus false safety, you know, we can talk about deep trust or authentic trust, which is a part of trusting culture, versus like a false trust.
Right.
Where we just say, oh, we're the best of friends. We're a great group. We do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. And this is why we're a great group. Here's our motto. And then we kind of go through the motions of pretending to live by that motto when in fact, underneath, we're not living. We're living a different reality entirely. Let's just say
that. And that is exactly how SE shows up, or authentic movement, in return, in regards to impulse. That tuning fork of like, this actually doesn't feel good. This isn't safe. Like being able to not just identify and take action, but begin to explore what that's like. I think what is fascinating to me about authentic movement is I have to continually come back as a witness to how I'm being with. We talked about like how to be with people. How am I being with? How am I assuming? How am I showing up to really fully take in this human being in front of me? What ways have I been patterned and conditioned? And what are the stories my culture has told me about how to be a witness? And how do we return underneath those layers? How do we seek, or what shows up when we start to liberate ourselves from that kind of movement patterning, whether it's through your eyes, through your thinking, through your impulse movements, reactions? How do we begin to free up a little bit of that enough that we are connecting in a different way? We're being with each other in a new way. We're building a new way of being.
And you say, you might notice I don't use the word trauma. I have trouble feeling anchored using that word in supporting my own or other people's processes from renegotiating their unique and difficult experiences in life and in fully exploring how their body, mind has patterned around their wounds and healing. So can we talk about that just for a moment? We could do a whole talk on just this. In the work we do, it's really hard not to say the word trauma. But it really is kind of a thing that we face. So can you just talk about that in terms of your own experience?
The gravity of trauma creates an orbiting around it that feels what is the opposite of like life affirming? It feels I begin to rotate and orbit around trauma. It holds such mass that it attracts the things to it, and then we orbit around it. And even just the word holds a weight and a charge that all the words on the page then orient around. All the ideas, all the movements start to orient around it. And I don't want trauma as my son. I don't.
Right.
I want burning fire aliveness to be the center of my universe. And so part of what happens, and maybe it's you said earlier, I love it, is like, why don't we just make a new word, or find out if we normalize the word trauma enough that it can take on more nuance or more diversity? Because right now everybody has an association with that word. And it just isn't effective if I'm trying to explore things that are life-affirming or emergent in creation and creativity. That word really can interrupt that process. And so I try not to incorporate it in the things that I write or in the way I run workshops. It's not that I don't think it's real and that it's there. It's just that it is, I have to find a way to dance with it that doesn't, where I won't lose my ground and get pushed.
Mm-hmm. So I talked about losing my readers in my newsletter by using the word trauma, and you're talking about losing your ground. So you're talking about an individual experience, which is, of course, where it all begins. We're all dealing with trauma individually, but collectively, even the last few years, since the 2016 election in particular, and with COVID, we have endured a collective trauma, which is why I think that Biden or some president should make a position in their cabinet, Ministry of, you know, the psyche, Dr. Fauci, as Monica Lewinsky, she had the same idea. She said, yeah, we need a Dr. Fauci of the psyche. And so this would be a part of allowing us to look at trauma in a way to find out what its gifts are. A big part of why trauma takes over is because it's so negative. It has such a negative charge. Our mind is attracted to it for that reason. We're wired to go for the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Rather, fixing a problem rather than finding a solution. So we do the same thing with trauma. It captures us because it's so dark and scary. It's the same reason we like to hear a good ghost story or a good Greek tragedy with lots of blood left on the stage afterwards. You know, trauma has gifts, and you know, that's a big part of what somatic experiencing is about, is learning, touching those discomforts, getting to the point that we can touch the discomforts when at first we can't even think about them, and then holding them and finding out what is needed here. What you can almost, you know, there's a Tibetan practice called feeding your demons, where you find a problem in yourself, a fear, let's say, or an angry place, and you ask that place, what do you need?
Mm.
And you listen, just like you would a child when a child is having a tantrum. Wait, what is going on? What do you need right now?
Mm.
So if we could get to that place with trauma, then we could hear what the trauma is actually, the so-called trauma symptoms are trying to tell us.
Mm.
Because, of course, there's lots of wisdom. The trauma is the body's way of presenting us with it's trying to protect us. It's trying to present us a new way to look at something, maybe warn us about the way we're currently doing things. You know, there's a lot of good in trauma, not a lot of good in trauma. That's not what I want to say.
Yeah.
Trauma doesn't happen because the body wants to punish us. We think that because we don't trust the universe. We don't have a trusting culture.
Yes. Yes to all of that. And trauma is part of life. It is exactly part of life. It's, if you think of how do you build muscle, how do things grow? There's a component of trauma. It has to be part of the equation. So when I say I don't want to orient around that which is not life-giving, that's my version of like culture's response to trauma. But I love how you're describing it, because it is part of this. It's inside the sun. It is a fiery, burning inferno of gases. I mean, there's destruction there, and it's warmth and light too. It's trauma is, there's no way that we could not have trauma and be alive.
Yes.
So if that's true, then how do we explore it without having all of these rejections or reactions to it? And part of it is, you know, when we think of strategy and when I talk about reverence for impulse, it's because it is brilliant at keeping us alive. Threat response to trauma is the beautiful, eloquent, incredibly concise and effective way of keeping us alive.
Yes.
It orients us. Trauma brings your systems in line. That sort of threat response organizes your system. So when I talk about structure being important, it's not that we want to let go of organizing. We need organizing factors, because if we were just inside exploratory, opening up non-orbital movement patterns, we would, like you said, we couldn't get up and have coffee. Like we need patterns, and we need ways of organizing. And what I love about what you said is that organizing in our system around trauma is also something to explore, not to continue try to eliminate or reject. That it's something to incorporate into this process of knowing yourself, of expanding your version of self. Yeah.
It's not that we have to try to seek to have trauma so that we can learn.
Girl, there's enough out there.
right. I like Peter Levine's story about watching the National Geographic documentary where some animals in the wild, you know, I think it was baby tigers were playing, and they got too close to a lion's den where the lion mother had babies. And so she chased the baby tigers and they ran up a tree to escape. And then eventually the mother lion went back and left them alone, having taught them their lesson. And they came down the tree And they immediately started chasing one another, taking turns, running one another up the tree. So there you have trauma and resilience in one tight little story. It's like two sides of the coin.
Yeah.
When you see that, you're like, where does the trauma end and the resilience emerging begin? Mm.
And the culture has to support that metabolizing of trauma. So the traumatic energy of retention in their body, they ran around and then metabolized and no longer held that trauma within their body. We need culture that supports that movement. I need to be able to run outside and shake and chase and do whatever I do to metabolize whatever traumatic response is showing up in my body. It's not that I'm saying we should all be, you know, flinging ourselves around but there's a cultural norm or there's a movement pattern we've adhered to that does not allow us to metabolize traumatic retention. Doesn't let us chase around the tree to get to process it so that we are resilient.
Yes. So we walk around carrying layers and layers of stuffed down trauma that then causes us to do things that we wouldn't otherwise do.
I say we don't metabolize it, but also we do. All the ways we do. We dance. I make, you know, authentic movement groups. Like because there's something driving inside us that knows how to build resilience, how to metabolize that, how to integrate that process. If we can listen in deep enough to be guided by it, I do think that we'll be moving towards a culture that supports that kind of resilience.
Oh, that's so nice to hear. That's a perfect note to end on. So positive that we could actually realize this, that we are moving towards a culture, a trusting culture. Weena, thank you so much for this talk.
Mm, thank you so much, Tina. This has been so fun and so inspiring and enlivening.
This was a conversation with Weena Pauly Tarr, a somatic experiencing therapist, a practitioner of authentic movement, and the creator of SEAM, S-E-A-M, Somatic Experiencing Plus Authentic Movement. And that's what we've been talking about, how these two modalities can combine consciously to support and inspire a reverence for impulse. I hope you've enjoyed listening to this talk as much as we've enjoyed having it. Thanks, and see you in the next talk.